There are armed conflicts, civil wars, insurgencies, invasions all over the world. In Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Nigeria, Ukraine, South Sudan, Gaza, Somalia, Yemen, everywhere you look, the world is at war. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and today, why? Nobody wants war. War is hell. And yet, as a species, we seem incapable of pulling off lasting peace. So maybe, just maybe, the issue is not what's wrong with war, but what's right with it. Because it must be doing something for us. That sounds like a terrible thing to say, doesn't it? And yet, political scientist Benjamin Ginsberg argues that war does have clear benefits. We just don't want to admit it. He makes the claim in a new book with a provocative title, The Worth of War.
People are not happy to hear about war in anything but the most negative light, but let me say that I wrote this book in response to a bumper sticker. I got tired of seeing that bumper sticker we all see, war is not the answer. And I said, look, it depends on what the question is. And war is often the answer to the most important questions of political life, statehood, territoriality, power. What states exist and what states don't exist is nearly always decided by war. Every contemporary state is the product of war and violence, for better or worse.
You're not saying that's a good thing, are you?
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I am a proponent of being realistic. And the real world is not what we would like it to be. In the real world, war and violence are the normal state of affairs. And to try to deny that, to engage in wishful thinking, is dangerous. So when I call the book The Worth of War, it was designed to make people stop and become annoyed and see what it was that I had to say.
When you say the worth of war, it sounds as though you're saying there are cases in which it's worth people dying. And the thing is, that's how most wars start, right? People feel that there is some central issue so important, so overwhelming that it's worth a lot of people dying for. And then the whole thing turns into a slaughter. You know, there's trench warfare, or there are atomic bombs or napalm or mass rape or hospitals are bombed. And it just seems wrong to say, yeah, but, you know, think of the benefits.
You know, the emphasis that I give in the opening chapter of the book, I borrow from Thucydides, the great Greek historian, the chronicler of the Peloponnesian Wars. Thucydides said war is a stern teacher. And what does it teach? It teaches people to think clearly, to think rationally. That seems to fly in the face of our own idea of war as irrational, horrible, you know,
driven by emotion.
Driven by emotion. But Thucydides said that those unable to think rationally, those unable to think logically, those who base their lives on delusion, they will not survive the audit of warfare.
I don't know, Ben. That suggests that we've had so many wars, then you'd think human beings would be getting smarter and smarter. You know, I mean, look at the Middle East. I don't think you can argue that we're getting smarter.
Well, to some extent, we are smarter and smarter.
How?
I'm not saying civilization might not have advanced with that war. But in point of fact, war has been a great force advancing civilization. As I mentioned, much of the technology we use was developed as a result of military needs. Now, you know, war doesn't advance basic science, but it certainly advances the application of science to human endeavors. Everywhere you look around, microwaves, jet aircraft, nuclear technology, chemical technology, all of this was advanced as a result of military needs. You know, your peaceful city planner has as his ancestor or her ancestor a military planner.
So are you saying that the origin of the state, in some ways, the origin of the nation, is in war?
Well, of course it is. That's what states are for.
To make war?
To make war. That's what they do. I think that's the only thing they do well.
I thought they were there to provide for their citizens.
Well, they are. The first goal is to protect their citizens. You know, states are a kind of protection racket. You pay taxes in exchange for protection from foreign and domestic foes. The advent of states has been a great culling process in which those that can effectively wage war are still with us, and those that can't wage war are no longer with us. You know, this is a harsh reality. We don't like it. Very often students will say that, sure, it's true that sometimes you need to, protect yourself against evil people, but there are nonviolent means that have proven to be very effective. And they point to Dr. King, to Gandhi. And I like to tell them that nonviolence is a misnomer. Nonviolence is actually better called violence light, because nonviolence...
What?
Violence light. It entails, it's a disruptive form of activity, often designed to incite violence on the part of its opponents. You know, when you think of Dr. Martin Luther King, his most famous and successful protest march, Selma, Alabama. Why was Selma chosen as the target of protest? Well, because the authorities in Selma were known to be quite stupid, and Dr. King could count on them to respond to peaceful protesters with violence. And this violence would be used against them.
So you've sort of been, you've been making the case that war is inevitable. Maybe we just think it's inevitable because it always has been. That doesn't mean it will be in the future.
Well, that's correct. We don't know what the future holds. We do know that war has been a main driver of history. And we know that as we look around the world, there are groups and forces and individuals with hostile intent. There are people out there who hate us. It's not that they don't know us well. It's not that, you know, they have some illusions about us. They hate us. That's just a fact. There are people who want what we have. There are people who believe they would benefit if we disappeared from the face of the earth. So I think it's... in my mind, folly to think that war can be banished in this reality. Perhaps there's some other Star Trek reality where everyone is peaceful, but there's no reason to believe that we'll achieve that in the near term.
Benjamin Ginsberg teaches political science at Johns Hopkins. His book is called The Worth of War. And if you thought that was a provocative title, how about this one? War is beautiful. That's the conclusion writer David Shields came to after studying hundreds of war photos, all of them taken since 9/11, and all of them published on the front page of the New York Times. Shields says the Times has made war beautiful, and he thinks that's a terrible problem. Charles Monroe Cain sat down with David Shields to talk about war photography and beauty.
I want to use the word you used because I found that to be very powerful. And the word you used is beautiful. War is beautiful is the title of your book. Talk about provocative.
Right.
And these photos, you know, I was like, okay, I get your argument, blah, blah, blah. I got your book. Oh, my God. They are beautiful. Like, they're really
Thanks.
Beautiful. Yeah, they could be hanging in a museum. What's wrong with that? What are you getting at with that?
For 20 years, from the first Gulf War until through 2013, I would be struck by at least a couple times a week and sometimes several times a week, I'd be struck by pictures of war that sort of fed my war porn addiction. You know, it was really, these pictures were surpassingly beautiful. They were basically war as, what would you call them, kind of 20th century modernist masterpieces, picture after picture, photo after photo, seemed to me to be virtually appropriating Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Jasper Johns, Richard Diebenkorn. I mean, it was just stunning to me how much of the war had been abstracted away from any kind of raw, naked, visceral horror and sort of uploaded into a realm of very abstract horror. The opening line of the book is an epigraph from Edmund Burke, who says that horror is very beautiful when kept at a severe distance. And it seems to me that these pictures function to disseminate a certain kind of ideology subtextually, namely that we sort of tell ourselves as readers of the paper that we're informed and somehow semi-concerned citizens and that we have properly bleeding hearts. But in reality, these pictures keep the war at, you might say, psychic arm's length, which to me enables the war to be fought and for consent to be manufactured. They're really important pictures in my view.
Okay, you know, I look through them and I was struck by two things. One, that they really weren't as graphic as I thought they were going to be. And two, that they're still very powerful and beautiful. And they're that at the same time. What do you want? Do you want more carnage? What do you want us to see?
You know, General Sherman said war is hell. And these pictures portray war as a sort of very pretty heck. First of all, I want us as citizen readers to bring enormously needed skepticism to the cultural work that these pictures do. And then I want us to depend far less on institutions that work hand in glove with the U.S. government. And third, you know, struggle more with its happy willingness to print pictures that just swoon in a kind of corporate folk art.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I can imagine someone saying, you know, man, they're only photographs. What's the harm?
On the one hand, you could say, what's the problem? You know, so what? You know, the Times runs 365 pictures every year, and here's a picture. But I looked at literally 9,000 front pages of the New York Times through microfilm and microfiche from 1991 through 2013, and we found 1,000 color war photos. Color pics started in October 97. We found 1,000 color war photos, and of those 1,700 fulfilled my criterion of pictures that, in my view, aestheticized horror. And I found precious few examples that, to me, in my view, conveyed the raw horror. So you could say, you know, what's the harm? But I guess the book is trying to argue that what subcurrent is running underneath that picture? Is there an irreducible glamour? Where is the horror? Where is the cost?
Is that policy or just happening kind of on accident?
I think that's the $64,000 question. I mean, this book is not an investigative book in the sense that I've uncovered 47 internal memos at the New York Times in which Dick Cheney and John Kerry have sent memos to the New York Times, and they said, if you ever print a picture of a dead soldier, that you will be denied access to the higher levels of government. You know, I don't have any such proverbial smoking gun. And I think it's an open question as to what's happening. Have all these photographers simply gone to school on the Western pictorial tradition and they can't help but take pictures of war as romance, as glamour, as beauty, as glory? Have the photo editors gone to school on the same tropes? To what degree does the New York Times instantiate its own authority by having access to the U.S. government and major government policies being sent directly to the New York Times? To what degree does that access depend on the Times, in my view, pseudo-covering the war? You know, Lyndon Johnson said during the Vietnam War, I can't win this war without the support of the New York Times. And then I follow up by saying, a New York Times picture is worth 1,000 mirrors.
You know, our country has been at war now for 14 years, which has kind of blown me away when I think about it. There's a lot of images from those wars that we've seen, just still images. Have they seduced us?
To me, these pictures are effective seduction, because if these pictures appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or USA Today or the New York Daily News, there's no story because people understand those papers to be rightward-leaning, military-leaning, Fox News-esque, Murdoch-esque papers whose agenda is quite clear. But the Times' brand is weirdly a kind of quasi-neutrality. And I think seduction is particularly problematic when we don't know the agenda of the seducer. And I even feel somewhat complicit. I wish I had gotten this book done 10 years earlier. It definitely took me too long to realize what was happening and too long to produce the book. So I'm proud of the book. I think it makes a relatively good case, but I felt seduced for too long, and this book is an attempt to, you know, break that seduction.
David Shields' new book is called War is Beautiful, the New York Times Pictorial Guide to Armed Conflict. Charles Monroe Cain talked with him. And you can see some of the Times photos they were talking about on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we've been talking about why countries and people choose to go to war. And so far, we've talked about the romance and the glamour of war, and even about some of the potential benefits of war. But sometimes, the rationale for war can be summed up in one word: revenge. That's a major theme in a new novel that's getting a lot of attention. It's called Green on Blue. It's the story of a little boy in Afghanistan whose name is Aziz. His brother has been badly wounded, and Aziz is looking for revenge. Somewhat surprisingly, Green on Blue was not written by an Afghan writer, but by an American who served in the war there. Raymond Tangakar sat down to talk with Elliot Ackerman.
I served in Afghanistan between 2008 and 2011 in special operations. And so in that capacity, I was an advisor to Afghan troops. So I spent all my time fighting there alongside Afghans, you know, with a few Americans interspersed amongst us. You know, my war buddies, in effect, weren't exclusively Americans. They were these Afghan soldiers. And we did all the things, you know, people do when they go to war. You know, we fought alongside one another. We bled together. We mourned friends together. But when I came home, these weren't a bunch of guys that I could keep up with on Facebook or call long distance or even, you know, go get 50-cent beers with at the local VFW. Mm-hmm. You know, they were trapped in Afghanistan's elliptical war. And being so trapped, you know, I knew I was never going to see them again. So for me, you know, I wrote this book wanting to lend voice to my Afghan friends. And if I'm being honest, too, I also wrote this book because I was really reckoning with the loss of those friendships. So I sort of hope that it stands as a testament to the war that we all fought and from their perspective.
Well, the whole story kicks off with this explosion in Aziz's town, and this attack ends up injuring his brother. And it sets Aziz off on a mission to actually avenge his brother's injury. I mean, revenge plays a really important role in this novel. Throughout the book, you refer to it using the Pashto word badal. How true is this to what you saw in Afghanistan?
You know, it's absolutely true. So the concept is one of what's called Pashtun Wali, which literally translates as the way of the Pashtuns. And the place it's most famously probably in, you know, American popular consciousness is the story of, you know, Marcus Luttrell and Lone Survivor. When those SEALs were overrun, most of them killed, Luttrell was actually taken in by an Afghan man. And when the Taliban came to say, hey, give us this American, he refused. And it wasn't because this Afghan was a great supporter of the U.S. cause in Afghanistan. It was because part of Pashtun Wali, the way of the Pashtuns, is this tenet called Melmastia, which means hospitality, which means if somebody comes to you in duress, you have to take them into your home and protect them. So the Pashtun people take this very, very seriously. They like to say, you know, we've been Muslim for 1,400 years, but we've been Pashtun forever. So it's even more fundamental to their identity than Islam is. But for Aziz, you see it in that his brother is terribly disfigured in the opening pages of the books, and he pledges himself to get badal, which is another pillar of Pashtun Wali, which most closely just translates as revenge. And his desire to get not only badal, but also his need to keep his brother in the hospital to tend to his injuries leads him into joining a militia called the Special Lashkar, which operates in a remote border part of Afghanistan. And what you sort of see is Aziz's descent into a war that in many ways is being fought for every single reason but the ending of the war. And that sort of becomes Aziz's story.
Was that the story of the war in Afghanistan while you were there? I mean, was Badal the driving force behind the war?
You know, we've been fighting in Afghanistan for almost 15 years now. And one has to ask the question of, is this war going on because we haven't been able to, you know, win enough battles? Or is it going on for other reasons? And I think the war can really, war can elevate people. So, you know, I had a commander I worked with who before the war was basically a sharecropper. And, you know, the war picked up in earnest. He showed a real aptitude, a managerial aptitude, I guess you would say. And he ascended to be the chief of a pretty powerful militia. So for him, you know, the war ending really wasn't in his best interests. You know, the war had elevated him. And if it ends, that gets taken away from him. So when wars get set up in that way, again, you can have people fighting wars for every reason but the ending of them. And the war kind of takes on its own type of economy in terms of the peoples whose careers and interests it's perpetuating.
Would you mind reading a section for us?
Sure. So this is a section where Aziz has he's joined up with the Special Lashkar, which is this militia, and he's speaking with Commander Sabir about incidents that are going around in a village where they're trying to build an outpost and one of the elders in that village. This is Aziz's voice. He searched my face as he had done the moon a moment before. He drank some more, saying, "Worse than Haji John is this fool at all. He claims to care for his village, but what does he know of such cares? I am responsible for the soldiers here. I care for your broken families. I give you food and a roof, and I give you the chance for Badal." The moon emerged from a cloud, and in its light, Commander Sabir fumbled at the ground by his feet, searching for Omar's can of fish food. "What of our Badal?" I asked. "What of it?" he replied, still groping at his feet. "We are sick of checkpoints," I said. "We want to strike at Ghazan. That is why I came here. That is why we all came here, for Badal." I thought he would grow angry at this, but he said nothing. He found the fish food and opened its lid. The air turned sharp with the smell. He shook the flakes onto the water's surface. They came slowly from the can. Harder and harder he shook, speaking all the while. "We do anything for Badal, because to do nothing is shameful, and shame is feared more than anything. When I killed Hafez and took Badal from my brother, I was very afraid." His voice trailed off. He looked up from the water and held me in his stare. "What will you do after we kill Ghazan?" he asked. "I'll go back to Orgun, care for my brother, and try to find work." My words hovered in the air, weightless with all they presumed. Commander Sabir listened and unscrewed the cap from the fish food, blowing through its sieved holes, clearing it. Flakes rose into the air, floating down, dusting my hair and face. He screwed the cap back on. Omar bobbed on the water's surface, his one slick eye winking at me as he waited for his meal. "There are many in the Special Lashkar who've taken Badal," said Commander Sabir. "Ask Isak or Yar whether it undoes the pain that has been. Ask them why they're still here, fighting. The war sustains us. It can be a life."
Thank you. Well, time and time again throughout the novel, this whole concept of Badal is used as a recruiting tool. You see commanders like Sabir, you know, invoking it in order to get young boys to join his militia. Is that something that you witnessed firsthand?
I think it often would sustain people, you know, the idea of revenge, the idea of, you know, a wrong needing to be righted. But I think there are also, you know, much more immediate concerns. I mean, things, you know, quite frankly, as simple as drawing a paycheck. You know, one of the things that really struck me in Afghanistan, you know, as opposed to I fought in Iraq as well, you know, and in Iraq, there was sort of this sense that, you know, the war has come here, we're at war, but war is not the usual condition for us, that the war will end and we will go back to our lives as they usually are. In Afghanistan, that really didn't exist. War was business as usual. And that makes sense. I mean, you know, the Soviets invaded in 1979. And something that also always struck me was, you know, the average life expectancy of a male living in the provinces of Afghanistan is just under 60 years old. So the war's been going on for now 36 years. So that's 1979. So the men who are dying off in Afghanistan right now were in their early 20s when the Soviets invaded. So in about another 10 years, you're not going to have really anyone left in Afghanistan who can remember that country at peace. So what happens when nobody can remember that country at peace? How do you get to peace? And it stops becoming an act of memory or a returning to normalcy. Peace sort of has to become this sheer act of imagination. You have to imagine it out of whole cloth. And I think that has a profound effect on a society.
For you as a novelist, is war your what inspires you? Is it your muse?
When Faulkner accepted the Nobel Prize, he made this great point, which is he said, you know, the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And I think that, you know, war is a place where you can, you know, you really see that laid bare. You know, thou shalt not kill is pretty fundamental to being a civilized human being. And this is the one endeavor where there is sanctioned killing, sanctioning your heart to be, your civilized heart to be in conflict with its savage heart. I don't like to say that you never escape war because it sounds so limiting, but that experience gave me a fundamental understanding of what it means to be a human being. And I'm always writing about the human experience, and my understanding of the human experience is informed by war.
Elliot Ackerman's novel is called Green on Blue. He served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's the recipient of the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart. Raymond Dungacar talked with him. So it can be tempting to think that war is inevitable, that human beings are just too violent or too aggressive, or we just basically suck too much to maintain any kind of lasting peace. So here's an argument on the other side. Back in 2003, there was a civil war going on in Liberia. Remember, it was a war that had gone on seemingly forever. There were unspeakable atrocities on both sides. And then a woman named Lima Bowie basically stood up and said, enough. She gathered the women of Liberia together in a nonviolent protest, and it ended the civil war. Not only did her efforts lead to the ouster and the imprisonment of the dictator Charles Taylor, she also won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. Bowie told Steve Paulson that war-torn Liberia had gotten so bad that she just felt like she had to take matters into her own hands.
Liberia had gone from bad to worse to ridiculous. That is how bad it was. People were inventing new ways of killing people. Pregnant women were being degotted. People were using plastic bags to drop in people's eyes and melting hot objects over people's bodies. So it was a terrible time. Especially women, rape was a common phenomenon at that point in time. There was no regard for women or their place in society or their lives. It was just easy to humiliate, rape, and to oppress them.
So it was truly awful. I mean, it frankly looked hopeless. So why did you think you could do something about this?
Well, there is something about being pushed to the wall and being pushed so far back that you have 2 options to either give in or fight back. And we were at that place as women of Liberia where we had been pushed so far back. And the one thing that I can say was that we knew we would die. But the question was, do you want to die without even trying, or do you want to die and let the history be that you died trying? And we didn't think that we would bring peace, but we knew that we would try. We knew that we would give the world another side of the conflict, because all of the reporting had a different notion of boys with guns, men with money, drugs and diamonds and all of the different things. So when we stepped out, it was about changing the narrative about war.
There were so many things that you were up against. And I mean, one of them was that Charles Taylor had prohibited any public gatherings of protesters, but you and these other Christian and Muslim women in your movement gathered every day, and there were thousands of you demanding peace, demanding an audience with Taylor, which I guess raises the question, why didn't he arrest you, or why didn't he have you killed?
Well, that is the question that many people still ask still today, but I say one thing. What I've come to learn is that when you have brutal dictators and violent people, they have no response for nonviolence. So it totally took him off guard. It would have been easy for us to come out and throw rocks, and then he would have a reason for killing us. But how do you kill a group of people who sit there with a banner that says, we want peace now?
So incredibly dangerous, obviously. I mean, you said earlier that you assumed you would die during this protest. How scared were you?
There wasn't a lot of fear. In the initial stage when we started, yes, there were moments where I got afraid. But every day as we step out to protest, and every day as I got to know the women we were protesting with and know their stories, every day that confidence grew, the courage grew, and a lot of things. But there was very little fear by the time we entered the second week of protesting, let alone by the second year.
When did you think that you might actually have a chance to bring down Charles Taylor, to remove him from power?
When he agreed to meet us, because he had resisted and said no. When he agreed to meet us, something profound happened that day. We got to the executive mansion, and the soldiers said they had been instructed that if we were less than 25, we should not be allowed into his mansion. And then I asked, what if we're more than 25? And then they laughed, because at that time, there was so much fear around this figure, Taylor, that no one expected that more than 25 women would show up to protest him. And I said, what if we're more than 25? And he said, then you can come in. At that moment, we sent message up to where the women had lined up, over 2,500 of us, and said, calm down. And the soldiers saw that sea of white, and they were like, wow, these women are really serious.
It's just, it's an astonishing story. And partly what you're saying is that he and pretty much everyone else in Liberia was just assuming that you would be terrified to go in and meet with him. And that's sort of like, I mean, you somehow you managed to turn that around. I mean, you seem to get through that terror.
That day when we went to see Taylor, for me standing up to speak to him was, I just told myself, because they had given me a statement to read. And by the time I got up there, I said, I'm not going to read this statement because it's too sterile. It's just too neat for this man. I have to speak the truth about the situation of all of us women. We were refugees, we're internally displaced, we're victims of rape. We're living off of the streets. People and their children were dying on a daily basis. Our daughters and sons were being conscripted as small boys into his army, into the armies of the rebels. So I had to tell him this is the reality of the Liberian people. This is the reality specifically of women of this country. And there was no fear in that telling. All that was there was a huge sense of anger that this one man has put us in all of this mess. That was what I was thinking on that day.
Well, eventually, you brokered a peace deal. I mean, amazingly, a peace deal between Charles Taylor and the rebel warlords. You forced Taylor out of power, and he was later arrested for war crimes. Your movement led to the election of the first woman president in Africa. Truly a remarkable story. And it's remarkable partly because it's so rare. I mean, almost always it's the generals, not the peace activists, who win. And I guess it raises the question of whether peace really can defeat war in any systematic way.
Well, I think where we need to come in this world, especially now, is to understand that good can always overcome evil and peace can definitely defeat war. You know, war is, if you go back to the Liberian story, it was just a matter of time that peace was going to take over, peace was going to win, you know.
Why would that be just a matter of time? It would seem that it could just drag on forever.
Well, it would seem that it would drag on forever, but I tell you one thing, that even those with the guns, they always pick up the guns not in the name of war. And you need to remember that. When people go to war, they're always saying we're fighting in the name of peace, which is ironical, because there's no way fire can put out fire. So if you're going to war because you want peace, if someone offers you the perfect alternative to what you're killing yourselves for, you're bound to reach out and grab it.
But there are an awful lot of leaders, of historians, of philosophers who say war is inevitable, that we've always had war from the beginning of history. It seems to be a part of human nature. Are you saying war is not inevitable?
I can tell you one thing for free. Because of the way the world has come to glorify violence, that's why people think that war is inevitable. I think if we persistently and consistently throw out peace, as the only alternative. You know, let's take a step back and look at Syria. 4 years ago, Kofi Annan had a plan for peace. 4 years ago, the global leaders who are warmongers decided only a military solution would help us. 4 years later, we have a global catastrophe. I think 4 years ago, if they had taken on that peace plan that Annan put on the table, let's resolve this through dialogue, let's talk about this, let's beat all odds and spend hours sitting down instead of just picking up guns. Because gun is the easiest way and a cowardly way of solving problems.
You mentioned that it's usually the men in power who conduct these wars. I'm assuming you would say that women have a particular role, a special role to play in preventing war.
Oh, definitely. The way I talk about it when I go to places of conflict is that in communities where you have a lot of the recruitment taking place, the women are the ones who know every young person. And so the metaphor I would want to use is her house. If it is dark, she can walk in and touch anything. And if you decide to fix her house and leave her out of it, you're leaving a very vital component of that fixing out of it. The woman knows of all of the fighters who you can talk to on which way and bring them back to a point of understanding. You keep them out of the room. You keep the conscience of those men out of the room. You keep the history of their lives out of the room. You keep the interaction in the community out of the room. And I think it's important for people to understand that process of bringing the country back to stability needs the involvement, intervention of every member of the population. If you're leaving 50% of the population out of the process, it's like trying to see a whole picture with one eye cover.
You see what you're advocating here as being realistic. I mean, this is not just pie-in-the-sky idealism. I mean, it's sort of like, oh, if only we could do this. I mean, you think this works.
I think so. I believe it in my guts. And the reason why I'm saying it is, please help me understand. A few years ago, we're getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Today, we have ISIS. A few years ago, we got rid of Gaddafi. What we see in Libya is a total mess. A few years ago, Syria started with just protest, and then one armed group got in, another armed group got in. What we see now is another mess. Yemen and all of the bombings that have been taking place by the different high-power countries, if violence could end anything, our world would be a peaceful place. What we've seen in this short period from 9/11 till today is a world that is even more dangerous. You want to go to concerts, you think twice. More than ever before in the history of the world, everyone lives with a deep sense of fear. Today in Belgium, the entire country is locked down. Everyone is inside. If violence could solve any problem, why don't we have global peace?
That is a very good question. Wow, you are so inspiring. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lima Bowie talking with Steve Paulson. Lima won the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize for her role in ending the brutal civil war in Liberia. She's a single mother of six and executive director of the Bowie Foundation. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. So enough about war. Let's change the pace. This year marks the 50th anniversary of one of the greatest jazz albums of all time, John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. It's Coltrane's masterpiece, and for a lot of jazz fans, including Steve Paulson, listening to it can be a kind of spiritual experience. Steve asked two fellow jazz fans to help him understand the magic. He sat down with Bishop King, founder of the Church of St. John Coltrane, and with Ashley Kahn, author of A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album.
His first son had just been born, John Jr., and so he was at home in Long Island, new house that he had just bought, and he disappears for 5 days. And with, like, yesterday's clarity, Alice Coltrane remembers the moment of seeing him coming down from this little area upstairs in their home with his incredible smile on his face and a self-satisfied feel, which was very atypical for Coltrane, who was, if anything, driven all the time. He was always thinking about music, always had a saxophone in his hands. So here he was without his instrument, and the one comment he made to Alice was, "I've finally done it. I've finally got it all ready." And he was referring to this four-part suite that still didn't have a name, but would become A Love Supreme. He wanted the music to speak for itself. But there was one occasion that he decided, I'm going to state it in words, I'm going to state it with the music, and I'm going to get them to interrelate. It was the first time that we hear him actually talking, or in this case, chanting, on an album when he chants the famous A Love Supreme riff as part of the first part of the suite.
A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme.
People ask me all the time, why John Coltrane? And sometimes I just simply say, why do you light a candle in the dark? For light, you know. I think what happened to me personally had something to do with the forming of the church. And I always call it, referred to it as a sound baptism that I had when I went to hear John's preaching. And at that point, when we had what we call that effectual transference of the Holy Spirit from John's horn into my own being and our Reverend Mother, at that point there was an effective change that took place in my mind and in my heart.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about Coltrane's preaching. Do you mean that literally, or do you mean his preaching through his horn?
Preaching through the horn. Because I couldn't compare it to anything other than some of the most intense Pentecostal revivals that I had been to and grew up in.
So what gives this music on A Love Supreme its spiritual depth?
Well, there's Coltrane himself and his conviction. I mean, musically, spiritually, I mean, even down to the very tone in his saxophone, how deep he was willing to go in his blues roots, his spiritual roots, to get at basically a very human type sound. And it's that sound that people like Ravi Shankar or Bono from the group U2, Phil Lesh from the group The Grateful Dead, and I'm purposefully mentioning musicians who are outside of the jazz sphere, speak about the same honesty and depth of feeling that they feel every time they hear this album.
Tell me about your church, the Church of St. John, and what you do there.
What do we do there? What do you...
Well, I'm just wondering.
We praise God. We play music. We praise God. We preach the gospel. We baptize people. We have weddings. We do funerals. We do all the functions that the Holy Mother Church does in terms of the sacraments and marrying and bearing and preaching and...
I've heard that some of your services can last up to 4 or 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
How does a service tend to proceed What are some things that you do during a service?
We have the ancient liturgy of the African Orthodox Church. And you know, we've married some of the compositional pieces of John Coltrane's to that liturgy.
You know, the proceedings, if you will, of the album definitely suggest religious ceremony, both in name, in structure, and in the spirit of the music itself. Acknowledgement has this very warm, welcoming, benedictive type of tone to it. It really feels like you've just walked into a church or into a, you know, some house of worship. The next two tunes, Resolution and Pursuance, which are the most typically jazz 4/4 swinging musical pieces, themselves have this sort of holy roller feel, this idea that a preacher is preaching. And when Wayne Shorter, for instance, talks about this album, he talks about how you can hear Coltrane's grandfather speaking in some of his solos. And then you get to Psalm, which is a very meditative, very personal type of prayer-like dialogue between a man and his God, basically. And what it is incredible. It's Coltrane reading the words to the poem that he had, you know, printed on the album cover back in 64 through his horn. So the cadences of the words, the ebb and flow of what he has written, direct the rhythmic flow of what he's playing.
What kind of people come to your church? What's your congregation like?
Well, the people that come to the church are people of all different kind of backgrounds and nationalities and even religious persuasions. Even some atheists are leaning on that anointed sound of John Coltrane. So,
Would you like to start any other John Coltrane churches in other places?
Well, yes, I think that that is our desire, to really try to organize the spiritual community that we call of Coltrane consciousness and have those venues and those bodies that can express, you know, the power of the music. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we want to cover the globe with Coltrane consciousness, which would mean that we could very much see different spiritual communities coming up. Now, we as African Orthodox, of course, are of the Christian faith, you know. And John Coltrane said that my young man had asked him if he was a Christian. He said, yes, I am a Christian, and that my early teachings of the Christian faith and my mother and father were Christian. But it's always been a thing with me as to whether or not a man knows the truth. And he said, and every man has to find it for himself, and he felt that truth was without label. So I think that within every known religious experience that there is room for culture and consciousness, whether it be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, or Buddhism. I think that there are those people that have taken that course of discipline that are benefiting from John Coltrane's music.
That idea of unity is really what propels this work the most. You know, the way that his music reaches out and touches people beyond the jazz genre and also just beyond people have ever experienced American music or Western music, people in the classical world, rockers, hip-hoppers, etc., embrace this album with equal fervor. The God that he's describing, he does in so many different ways in this beautiful poem that he wrote on the cover, which is really the only time he ever did it on any of his recordings. He describes God in very biblical fashion. African-American preacher speak sort of pops up, as well as a sort of more Eastern mystical type of approach.
John Coltrane said that music is an instrument. It can create the initial thought patterns that can change the thinking of the people. And in the Psalms, it says, "Blessed are the people who know the joyful sound, for thou art the glory of their strength, and in thy favor our horn shall be exalted. My faithfulness and my mercy shall be with him, and in my name shall his horn be exalted." So it is in the name of God that this exalted one that we celebrate, that mystic Sri Rama Oneida Ruth, John Will.i.am Coltrane.
Bishop King is the founder of the Church of St. John Coltrane, and Ashley Kahn is the author of A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album. Steve Paulson talked with both of them because this year marks the 50th anniversary of A Love Supreme. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show. He had help from Raymond Tangekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.